Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. What's up, everyone, and welcome to Ringside. I'm John, and I smell like a buck, and I'm joined by Danielle Caroli, who probably doesn't smell like a buck yet.
My bucks are in rut, and they have bred does, but not for me. So today, I'm not smelling like a buck, but you know, that's just my life and everything's going well here. So what's going on there that you're smelling like a buck?
Oh, well, you know, we decided to breed a doe that was in heat today to our new junior herd sire, Ozzy. Gem, you know, the doe that I said we weren't going to breed, got bred.
So, and she's the first one bred for your herd too?
Oh, yeah. Yep. She's kicking it off for us, which is good because we'll need the milk since we'll have so many first fresheners this year or next year, I should say.
Hold on one second. There's just this memory coming back to me of a past podcast episode where you may or may not have given us a hard time about breeding plans changing and things happening that weren't set in stone. And here we are. You just bred a doe. You said you weren't planning on breeding. Should I start calling you Pot? Because you're, you know, Pot calling the kettle black here?
You know, Tierney listens to this podcast every week, my wife. And thankfully, we had put her, what had happened was, we put her on our breeding schedule. And there was some interest for kids out of her. So we're breeding her with the blessing of Tierney. And she's been bred now. We're just planning on not keeping the kids. So there's that. But yes, I don't know how many more heat cycles I could have gone through listening to her yell at me. So there's that. But it's fine. It's great. Listen, I guess it's because we're all in a good mood because we are getting ready for convention. The American Dairy Goat Association yearly convention is in Syracuse. And I know you're getting ready to hit the road here in a couple days. And I'll be hitting the road in 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, by the time this podcast airs, I will be living my best life in Syracuse, New York, and we will be getting ready for the live episode we're going to be doing with Farmer John of Beekman 1802 and enjoying seeing all of our goat friends in Syracuse.
It's super exciting. Can I rewind real quick? Just for like 2 seconds. Just for 2 seconds. Can I say how annoying it is to watch a baby buck figure out how to breed a doe?
Yes, you can say it.
Okay. It's annoying. It's like, ugh. So here's what made me think of this. Tierney walked in and I looked at her and I said, man, I'm really lucky that she loves me because I was frustrated. As so was the baby buck that was trying to climb our 9-year-old doe. I called her and was like, are you seeing me struggle out here? And she's like, yup. I'm like, do you think you can give me a hand? Tierney hates the smell of bucks, especially after she was pregnant with Alice. It's just, it made her sick. It was terrible. So I think she has like PTSD from that. And she walks out trying not to laugh. So she came out to help, but by the time she got out, he had tagged her one time, thankfully. And, you know, we were able to call it good. But, man, just waiting for them to figure it out, having to find the right angle of the dangle for them to be able to reach a bigger dough, it's just, it's frustrating. You have to be patient and take your time because you don't want to ruin a young buck making a bad experience out of it and yada, yada, yada. But I was just like, bro, come on. You're so pretty. Just breed her.
Oh, boy.
Nope, yeah, that was my little rant.
Rant, therapy session, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, those baby bucks, it's always interesting. Thankfully, I think that once they've had success once, and it was a, do we call it a, like, let's say positive experience is probably the best word for it. They typically know what they need to do after that, and they will be happy to oblige. But yeah, that first breeding for them sometimes takes them a little longer to figure everything out.
Yeah, once they get a taste for blood, they turn into a real Jeffrey Dahmer. I agree.
Nice. Let's compare these.
I'm sorry.
Let's compare our herd to crazy serial killers. Personality fits, you know.
Well, the new Netflix series came out, Dahmer, and it's actually kind of interesting. I started watching it last night, so that's why the analogy came right to my brain.
Oh, okay. It's Hocus Pocus here for us, so...
did Hocus Pocus 2 come out yet?
It did. And I haven't watched it yet because I was originally going to watch it kind of in the background as I was getting a few things done on my computer today, but felt like I couldn't give myself or give it my full attention. And so I was going to wait and probably will end up waiting until maybe sometime during convention or maybe when I get back from convention to actually watch it. But I did turn on the original Hocus Pocus, and that was in the background of my work day today. And I have to say, it's not a bad little movie to be watching as you're trying to put things together and do this and that on the computer. So,
well, I want to watch it with Tierney because it's her favorite movie. Can I just say that I wasn't a huge fan of Hocus Pocus 1? No? Is that blasphemy? No. Did we just become enemies?
I don't understand. It is an amazing movie. I was trying to put it on my TV at first, and I couldn't get into the app, and it's probably because it was crashed by all of these people trying to watch the second movie. I think it is one that everybody should enjoy.
Tierney just informed me that I'm not allowed to watch it with her the first time because I will ruin it. So
I guess that's good for you.
Well, if you're looking for something to do Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, we can have a viewing party.
Okay, that sounds good. I will definitely enjoy it with her. Though, disclaimer, I've been quoting the movie all day already, the original Hocus Pocus movie all day already. I can't say I won't quote some of the lines while we're watching it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Well, I mean, I guess we should kind of talk a little bit more about convention since we're getting ready. I have some sad news about convention for me.
And what is your sad news?
I'm not going to be able to make it Monday.
We're calling this sad news?
Wow. So, folks, what we're going to do Thursday is actually, for some reason, Danielle's not going to be available for the Ringside Live thing. So I will be accepting interviews for a new host because that hurt my feelings right there. How dare you?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, I guess I don't even have to. I'm not going to be there Monday. I don't even have to explain myself. Thanks, Danielle.
Well, no. Now you can explain yourself because you've kind of like put it out
dangled
there.
The fruit.
So what?
Dangled the fruit.
You and your dangling references. podcast. I apologize, everyone.
It's breeding season. I don't know.
So, well, you kind of started talking about it. And for those who don't know, why are you disappointed that you will not be attending convention on Monday?
Well, I'm so glad that you asked, unprovoked. I cannot attend on Monday because our great mother-in-law, who I love so dearly, has not been feeling well. And thus, we won't have anybody to watch Alice Monday during the day. Tierney's working. So I have to, of course, watch my daughter. Is it even, do dads call it watching, or is it just like exist with my daughter for Monday and, you know, have fun and do dad and daughter things? So I have to do that Monday. By the time Tierney gets out of work at 3:30, it takes 4 hours to get to Syracuse. We'd be talking about getting there at 6:30, 7 o'clock, and then just to turn around after the membership meeting, because that's why I wanted to go Monday, was to point out some things at the membership meeting. I'd have to turn around and come back home and get home at like 1 a.m. maybe, and then go to work the next day. Also, I have Alice on Tuesdays as well, so it just probably isn't a smart idea.
Yeah, it's just not in the cards.
If people would like to, you know, go ahead and say their piece at the membership meeting, I would encourage them to if you're attending, because the directors, although yes, they are on Facebook and they know how the members feel, I feel like it's time that everybody works together instead of working against each other and picking sides. And, you know, we keep hearing all over Facebook, conduct detrimental. Like, we need to stop that thought and start working together. And that includes the directors with each other, and that includes the membership with the directors and the office staff. And everybody kind of needs to kumbaya and get to work. So that's kind of the gist of what I was going to say there anyway. So if directors are listening, or if anybody wants to say something similar, not telling you that you have to, definitely voice how you're feeling to the directors, because, or whoever's in the room at that time, EC members, whoever, because you need to be heard. And that's the point of the whole convention, especially, you know, prior to the board meeting, for you to be heard. So I'd strongly encourage people to do so.
That's a great point. Let your voice be heard. Things to consider as a general membership, and definitely take a look at and make sure, if you feel passionately about something, let your directors know so they are aware of your opinion. Are all of the year-end reports that have been submitted from the various committees. And there are, for those who aren't aware, each year the committees present what they've done to the board at their annual meeting. And they also request board action if necessary. So some tasks and jobs are committee business, and that they can do the work without needing board approval. But then there's other things that, particularly if it changes rules in the guidebook or moving into new language, we need to have adaptations to the guidebook in terms of text, whatever it is. If they need to present something that requires board action, that appears in the end of your reports. And so before the directors discuss it, it's always good, first of all, to see what work the committees have done throughout the year, mm-hmm. but also see what they're proposing to the board of directors to become changes in the guidebook, changes in operations, things like that. So it's always important to become aware of things. I know, I think some of the hot button issues currently are the fact that Sables did not make numbers at the national show for the second year in a row. And so therefore, currently with the guidebook rules, they are now moving back to display status, I believe is the correct term.
Yeah.
And so they will have to once again qualify currently as all is proposed. They will have to once again qualify, meet the numbers in display status before they are allowed to exhibit and compete at a national show again. So that is one of those one of the things that is being presented to the board, and the board will have to make a decision on whether or not there's any wiggle room into that rule, or whether or not they want to put wiggle room into that rule, or if the Sables will go back. So there's things like that. On a kind of a cool note, there's a proposal to change the requirements for milk stars for Nigerian dwarf breeds in terms of butterfat, because they have found that the numbers from butterfat production in Nigerian dwarfs, I believe it's something like 98% of Nigerians on milk tests can achieve the current weights for butterfat requirements to earn their star. So they're proposing an increase, because after all the years that the Nigerians have been on milk tests and the data they've been able to get from the breeders who have been working with their does, milking them year round, creating this data set, they've determined that the bar was too low and we need to raise the bar in order to make that star for the Nigerian dwarf just a little bit harder to attain. And so I think that's a cool thing that they're going to have to accept. But there's just, long story short, there's just a lot of things that the board has to decide on based on information from the committees. And it's always good to just know what the committees are proposing, take a few minutes and read the year-end reports, just so that you're aware of the different irons in the fire that are going on, especially in years like this where we do have so much disrupted by issues with the NG computer system. There is still a lot of work being done in the registry. And so it's always important to take a few minutes and just be aware of it.
Well, I want to also rewind for a second.
What was that sound?
That was my rewinding sound. I hope it came across that well. That way. How do you feel about the whole Sable debacle?
Oh boy. I think that it's something that needs to be addressed. I am a firm believer that those numbers are there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so my opinion on this is that this is a consequence as a breeding group that the breeders are going to have to adjust to. And if they want Sables to continue to compete at the national level, this should be their wake-up call. I think it's okay that the Sable breed is put back on display status and they work towards getting those numbers up again and bringing them back to exhibition status, I want to say is the right word, and mm-hmm. being able to compete at nationals, because you cannot, just the history of this breed at the national level is more or less carried by probably one or two farms. Currently probably two farms that are carrying the Sable breed and the numbers
right. to make
the show official. And there are things that they've had to do in the past to keep these numbers going. But at some point, it's got to be on the group of breeders as a whole. And I don't think that weight of the breed is being placed on the breed, like all the breeders as a whole right now. And I think this should be the wake-up call that you have these breeders who have put in the work for years and years and years to get them where they were. And now everybody else has to step up too.
The breeders as a whole have kind of leaned on one or two breeders, like you said, to show up to nationals with numbers to make it okay. And I mean, we saw it this year. They had like 42 or something like that at nationals. That's seniors and juniors. Like, that's all that was in the show. And, you know, having to rely on just one or two people, like, that's not fair, first of all, to those two people. But then it's also not fair to the breed. Like, people should be bringing them out. And I get that there's not as many numbers. I mean, shoot, in the Northeast, they're pretty much non-existent here. You know, we've got a couple here and there, but they're never sanctioned ever around here. And, it, you know, it's just kind of where we're at, the pocket we're at. So, of course, for Harrisburg, because of that, you didn't see many at nationals, and it showed. And I think that, personally, I feel like rules are rules right now. It's nothing personal against the sable breeders. If it was Oberhausen, I'd be like, well, those are the breaks. Like, these are the rules. You know, 2 years in a row of not meeting numbers, like, you're back down to exhibition status or display status. And it really stinks. And, you know, maybe they'll make some sort of asterisks for this because, you know, 2020 there was, or 2021, there was still COVID stuff going on, and, you know, people didn't feel safe to really travel still, even though there weren't any restrictions. It just kind of depends on where the board and the committee wants to take it. But for me personally, I feel like, well, rules are rules, and unfortunately they're going to have to go to display, and they're going to hit those numbers easily. I mean, next year we have West Coast, where Cliz Foster is at. So you know that there's going to be plenty on display. And then the next year, I think, is Midwest or wherever. And people will probably travel for that too. So they'll meet those numbers again. So then they'll be able to go back up to exhibition status, like you said. It's just, it stinks. I mean, I see so many people, like, you know, the posts on Facebook about it. And it's like, well, I feel you. And I feel for the breeders, and I feel for the breed, but at the same time, it's like, why are we going to bend for them? What if it, you know, what if it happens with Guernseys in the future? Are we going to be like, oh, but guys, it was a weird year? You know, I think that, you know, if you bend for one breed, you're going to have to bend for another. And I think it just kind of starts a snowball effect that nobody wants.
Right. And then the rules exist for a reason, and obviously with board action, rules can be changed, but they're there because you, for on a cost basis, you need a certain number to justify having the breed exhibited at nationals. You need enough so that this way the breed is represented well. And if you can't maintain that, are we there right as a breed at the moment to really exhibit on a national stage? I mean, nationals is the premier show of the industry. And It's not just breeders in this country that come to the show, but it's also breeders from around the world. And they're coming to watch and see what should be the best of the best. And if there is not enough animals in this breed currently that want to show at a national level, should they really be there? Are we going to bring out goats that shouldn't even be competing at a, and I'm not saying that this is where, I don't think that I'm saying that there's no nice sables or anything. But what I'm saying is, if we're just bringing out goats to meet numbers, which yes, they'll have to do, but if the quality is literally anything that has four legs, what does that do for the breed? And what does that do as a representation for the breed? And I've kind of talked, we've talked about this a little bit with the Guernseys as well. Again, were they ready for a display status? Was the breed where you really wanted it to be at that national level to showcase the animals correctly, you have to remember that this is a big, impressive show. And yes, believe me, I have seen gorgeous sables that I'm drooling over, and they're out there. But are the numbers out there that they can truly, again, command that national stage like we want them to? I mean, that is all it is. And that is why those numbers exist, because you want to bring a show where it is impressive to see those champions, and that national champion means something.
You know, it's quality over quantity sometimes, right? And if you're just bringing whatever has a pulse, like you said, yeah, it's... We said the same, like you said, we said the same thing about the Guernseys. Anyway, I guess we kind of should talk about our topic that we want to discuss today.
Go for it.
All right. Well, today we're working off of no notes. We just decided to kind of wing it. We're talking about strong dam lines, right? The strong doe line that you have in your herd and that everybody talks about. I guess we should first start off with what is a strong doe or dam line, whatever you want to call it.
I want to rewind, as you've said. Oh, perfect. part of why we wanted to talk about this is when we were talking to all of those exhibitors about their animals that were submitted into the spotlight sale and accepted and will be being bid on and all of that fun stuff and all the glory, the glitter and the glory and the spotlight at the end of this week, one of the things we heard time and time again is the importance of that dam line. And the dam line is what makes or breaks the doe.
Yep.
And yes, the bucks have influence, and yes, they'll add this and that. But the true success and testament to a breeding program is the dam line. Wouldn't you agree on that?
Oh, 100%. That's the first thing people look at. Yeah, you know, the buck's the 50% of the breeding. When you're looking at the buck, you're not looking at him himself. You're looking at his doe line behind him, too. So, yeah, doe line, dam line comes first and foremost. That's the first thing I look at when I'm looking at animals to possibly purchase is, okay, what's the dam look like, the grand dam? You know, can I draw a line on the consistency that I want out of an animal?
So then what makes a dam line for you? What is your personal definition of dam line?
A strong dam line to me is one that throws the most, like I said, consistency. You know, you have a lot of data behind them as far as, you know, maybe some linear appraisal scores. But even if you don't have that, just looking at strong animals that are producing better than what they are consistently, right? You don't want, you know, oh, this dam's really nice, but her daughters, they've all been culls because, you know, she can't reproduce it. Then most likely it's not a strong dam line. You know, we've seen some national champions that the buck kind of stops with them. You know, they go national champion. That's, they deserve to win. But then when you look at their progeny, nothing really stuck. So a strong dam line to me is something that can reproduce itself or better.
So for you, the power in a dam line is the power and success of a brood doe.
It can be, yeah. Yep.
But isn't that... No. I'm just saying, is that what you're saying there? That
yeah,
the value of your dam line is their ability to be a brood doe.
Well, yeah, because if we're talking about the line, you know, it's going to be an awfully short line if the strong dam line is one doe, right?
Well, but that's not a line. That's a doe.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It was just awfully short. And then you look behind them, and yeah, there might have been some decent animals there, but it's just kind of like an anomaly. You know, we've all seen it. We can think of animals in any respective breed that you're like, oh, where'd that thing go? And what happened with daughters? And then you're like, oh, I guess that wasn't really that strong of a line. It can definitely, I think that a strong doe line is one that can, like I said, reproduce itself or better. You know, you look at my doe Gem, and everybody's like, I'm guilty of saying it all the time, that she's the cornerstone of my herd. But is she? If you look at Jem, I have currently in my barn, I have Jem. I have a daughter who's dry. I had a daughter this year that was a 2-year-old second freshener that I culled. Any daughter of hers that has freshened on my farm, I've culled or sold, you know, depending on how you want to look at it. I have two granddaughters in the herd and a great granddaughter. And I'm like, you know, they're good. They're, you know, they've done well. They're not fresh yet. So it's like they're good right now, but who knows what they're going to turn into. So is she a strong doe line? I'd say not. She's producing animals that without the mammary system are probably stronger than her, but with a mammary system aren't.
That makes sense. But I think I look at a doe line slightly different than you do. And mm-hmm. I will give you that the success of a doe line or a dam line is based on what the future is and what they can produce or their granddaughters can do and everything like that. But when I think of a doe line, I think of it as kind of the consistency of animals that are directly related to each other. So that when you're making breeding decisions and plans for new purchases, you can utilize that consistency and the knowledge base you have with working with those animals to influence other decisions. So, for instance, I think of my herd coming from, and ultimately my herd was started from two half sisters from a doe, their maternal half sisters. But in my mind, and this is more for breeding purposes when I'm looking at bringing in more of a homebred herd sire too, but in my mind, there really is two separate styles going on from both sisters. So I have two dam lines in my herd. Now you go back one generation and you could argue I have one giant dam line, but that dam line branches and I know what's going on in these animals. I know that every once in a while, this animal is going to show up that maybe she's not exactly with what I would look for and expect, and let's say substance of bone, that while we're not going to call her frail, she might be a little bit more fine boned than what I want and what I expect. Now, if I give her a few years and turn around and just ignore her and let her kind of do her thing, I know she's going to get where I want to, but I also know that odds are she's going to have a sister who is going to be more showing us like a stronger bone pattern, she's going to have more substance of bone, or I can very easily breed her to something and get that bone pattern I more desire because I work with these lines. I know what they're going to do and how it's going to kind of work and what I'm expecting here. And so that to me is how I view my doe lines as kind of that crystal ball of what I'm expecting from kids versus looking for success. Obviously, I hope for success and that's a goal in my breeding program. But when I look at my doe lines, I use them as ways to group animals that are related because this is what I'm expecting of them.
Right. If that makes sense. No, it makes sense. No, I'm just like, so I guess I should kind of reiterate here that, you know, I haven't been working with my lines for, you know, 10 plus years. Right. So I'm still figuring out what's working, what's not working. When breeding X to Y, if that's going to what it'll create. Right. I mean, it took me, let's see here. Cause I'm looking at the list. It took me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 breedings with Jem to figure out, okay, this works and this doesn't work, right? So this buck works, this buck doesn't work. And it literally was all, I feel like I finally figured her out in multitude of ways with this darn doe last year. Like, I finally just was able to connect the dots. But yeah, you know, people have, like, you know, we're talking with Dr. Acton, you know, she's got the E line that goes all the way back to this. And like, yeah, there's traceability there. And that's kind of what makes a strong doe line, is you can kind of trace everything back to a certain doe that's kind of your spotlight doe that started it all. So that's also a portion of a strong dam line. In my farm, I'm working with, Merrimack line right now, Gem line, and the Carla line, which is half, you know, she was, her dam had the same sire as Gem. So it's kind of like a halvesy line, right? So I'm working with three different lines right now in my small herd. It's kind of a lot, I guess, for a small herd, but that's what we're doing. And you're working with, it's two, right? Like, you're started out with twin does, right?
So, yeah. So they were, well, they're a year apart and they were maternal half sisters. So ultimately you can go back and say it is one single dam line, but what happened was it just kind of worked out, and my one line, and I call it my Isabella line. And then I have my, because the first doe was, well, her dam's name was Isabella. My first doe was Alexandra Isabella. And so then all of the current does from her that have kind of went into my herd, starting with her last daughter kind of created the Isabella line. And so everybody is something Isabella. So I have a Madison Isabella, I have a Amada Isabella. I mean, the show stewards really love me when you start checking in animals and they all pop up and you know,
and they're all Isabella.
Yeah, exactly. When you have multiple kids in a show and it's like, oh, this is Countessa Isabella and this is so-and-so and, you know, Isabella, it's fun. But that way, that line just kind of, the animals I was using and what was in my herd when I was really, really small while I was in college kind of changed how that line looks. Versus my Carmel line, which really started with Cotton Candy. But so the cotton, well, no, actually, I should say it does start with Cotton Candy because I do have daughters from two different segments of that. But anyway, those does and the animals I used on them are slightly different than the animals I've used on my Isabella line, as we've just kind of been crossing. And now everybody is to the point where I'm actually able to, we're distant enough that I'm actually able to use a buck from my one side of it and have enough animals on the other side that I can work with and do slight line breeding. But it really is to the point where we're looking more at outcrosses, but I do know what I'm going to get from these animals and which side is going to kind of produce this or which is able to produce that. And then I actually have several does that are mergers again and putting the animals back together to create a single line again. So it kind of weaves out and then it weaves back in. And so that's kind of a cool thing for me with my dam line. I have a doe, I think currently, I probably have more, but I have one doe who comes to mind who is a, we used an Isabella line son on Carmel, our doe Carmel, and was able to create pretty much exactly what I wanted. Ironically, she looks more like her sire's side and she looks more like an Isabella animal, but she does have more maternally that Cotton Candy Carmel line. But it pretty much did what I was thinking it was going to do. She has the mammary system that has the components of her paternal granddam. She has the strength in feet and legs from her dam. I mean, if we're getting picky, she has her paternal granddam's top line, which, you know, or it's an improvement, but it's still there. You know, like there's things like that, that she's there. She's what I wanted and what mm-hmm. I would hope for from these animals and this line there. So it is cool. And it does help when I'm making decisions, because I can, the sentimentality of my herd and going, oh, this is so-and-so's last daughter, or this is the only one here, I can then go, oh wait, no, I made this, may be her last daughter, but I have her full sister, or I have this doe's full sister, or I have this doe's granddaughter. And so it does help with that as well, I think.
Well, let me ask you this. Okay. What does it take for you to add in a new doe line? Say, like, even if, like, say you're like, no, I'll never do that. But let's just say you would. What does it take? Like, what are the check marks that have to be ticked before you bring in a new doe?
I've considered this, and I have added does before in the past. And ultimately what happened was, when I needed to scale back way, way down, those animals were the ones that, while they were gorgeous, they were the first to go. Part of it was sentimentality and wanting to keep kind of my original lines going strong. But the other thing was that I couldn't work with them and have the success in the continuation, generation after generation, than I could with my doe line that I was working with, like my original doe line. They were nice animals and we've had nice daughters, but I just didn't have the history and knowledge of how to kind of work with them to really propel them to success. And at that time, it just had to be cut. And so that was where I cut and like pulled back. That yeah. being said, I think when do you add a new dam line is when you've exhausted the current dam line you have and you just can't improve on it anymore, or you're not where you want to be competitively, and you've done all you've basically could do. And so I think then it's maybe you consider, all right, maybe I, you know, take that board and just erase it, and we go back to the drawing board completely, because I've tried different bucks that I should have success with. I've worked with this, I've worked with this, but I am not happy with how my goats are advancing. That is when I would say bring in a new doe line. Because if you can't get your animals where you want them to be, or at least moving in the direction of where you want to be, and you've tried, maybe it's time to bring in that new doe line.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I always like a good second doe line for is for, or third or fourth, depending on the size of your herd and how many your animals you're working with. But when you have the knowledge of what a doe can do, you can then expect it in her daughters, but you can also expect it in her sons. And so when you're working with three doe lines, you can keep a buck out of doe line A and doe line B and doe line three, or what, you know, whatever you're calling them, A, B, C, D, whatever, and use those in your breeding program, so that this way you can probably more successfully influence what's going on in that next generation.
So for me, when I go to look at a new doe line, all right, let's just use Mary Mac for example, because she's the last doe that I brought in. So I knew that the style I'm working with isn't going to change overnight. Like, it's going to take some time. I had two other mature does that were twins, so they were essentially one line that I had sold. I wanted another line to work with. And as far as, like, yeah, I could go to the data of every single doe that I want to look at. Sometimes you kind of got to go with your gut too. I'm not saying that for everybody, like, definitely do your research, and I definitely did mine. But when I saw Mary Mac as like a 10-day-old kid, a picture of her, I called dibs immediately because her dam was nice. Not great. Not a great doe, but she's nice. Her sire has turned out to be a very pretty buck. Of course, you know, he's got some pretty powerful animals behind him. Just judging by her general appearance, I was like, yeah, I definitely want to call dibs on this doe. And she became available to me, and I didn't bat an eye. She does not come from a long line of excellent does on her dam side. Like, she just doesn't. But I was confident enough in my eye to go ahead and pull the trigger. And, you know, she's been a really powerful doe in the ring. You know, she earned her dry leg first ring out. She finished within her first two shows this year as a 2-year-old first freshener. She's just been a really powerful doe. And, you know, her daughter is just as beautiful. And you know, she got third place at nationals, and she unfortunately has hit shows in very gawky stages of her growth, but I'm fairly confident she'll be able to get her dry leg next year, then hopefully finish as a milker, you know, knock on wood that, you know, she makes it that long, right? Like, goats are goats. So I don't necessarily think you have to go with like the strongest of dam lines, but you know, data does help. I think that kind of when you think of like that doe line, it isn't like national champions behind them, you know, every single doe. Like, yeah, that's a really powerful, strong doe line when you have that. But you can also have a strong doe line with animals that maybe haven't seen the show ring a ton, maybe haven't been appraised at all. You know, who knows? You know, there's so many variables. But I think if you what really consists of that phrase, the strong doe line, strong dam line, is that, for me at least, that any animal born after that, when you're using quality animals on them, should be better, or the same, at least the same. But I mean, the real goal is to be better, and it should be a line that you can kind of lean on. Does that make sense?
No, it definitely does. And that's, I think, the importance of it. It's not the star-studded pedigree. It is the consistency in improvement. Right?
Yeah.
That the pedigree is nice. The ability to say, oh, this doe was best in show 20 times, and this is what she did, or this is what she did. And so she's in the pedigree. But as you said earlier, sometimes those animals do not reproduce well. And I look at Nubians, and I know that sometimes you can breed a beautiful Nubian on paper. She's everything. She's done everything. And you can find a buck that, again, on paper, he's everything. He's done everything. His daughters have done everything. But when you breed those two animals together, that kid, you may not even want to put a tattoo in her ear and associate her with you at all, which, please tattoo your animals. It's part of the Scrapies identification program. When they're moving, make sure they have permanent identification. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. But like, that animal may be hidden and quickly removed from your property, never to be registered, never to see the light of day. And on paper, it should have worked, but it didn't work because the consistency of the strength of improvement on the dam line isn't there.
I don't know what else to really say about a strong dough line when you're thinking about it. I mean, I think we've covered it pretty well. I think the phrase is thrown out there quite a lot. You'll say, you know, one of my best dough lines, you know, kid from one of my best dough lines, and you look and you're like, is it? Like, I mean, I guess if it's your best, sure, maybe. But I don't know if it's something to tote. And I don't really use the term too often because, again, I'm kind of still building mine. Jem, although she's a nice doe in her own right, hasn't been able to reproduce equally or better. I think there was a few daughters that I might have sold prematurely, but overall, and you know, you never heard from them again once you sold them, of course. That's how that goes. For the overall, I think that it takes a while to get to earn that right to say, I have this strong doe line, you know?
I would say that, or I would say something along those lines. I think the issue is, or the where it becomes the make or break is, can you use it to your advantage? And that's ultimately what'll make a line a strong doe line or a weak one, is are you able to take it and have success with it? And so I think when you're looking at it, you kind of backing up and going, well, what kind of advice would you want to put out there about doe lines? And for people maybe just starting out or thinking about, okay, should I be working with a different doe line here? What's going on? Is first, again, is there that consistency? But then, are you able to work with it and take it to the next level? And do you like what's represented there? I mean, I kind of think towards, all right, we have a new buyer. They want to get into goats. They want to be successful in, let's say, the show ring, because that's probably one of the easiest and consistent ways to measure your results of your breeding program as an industry. And so you have to go out, and typically you want to buy two does, or you buy a doe in a weather. But if you really want to kind of have that initial, as you're building your herd, typically you buy maybe two does. And my advice would be, maybe don't buy full sisters, but buy does from animals that are well represented in that breeder's herd, that you can see the doe, the grandam, the maternal aunt, this one, that, because ultimately that breeder is working with what animals will bring them success. And so if your animal's line is well represented in the herd and you admire that herd, that is probably where you want to go direction-wise of what to purchase. But then if you're buying two, I would make sure you're buying animals that are very similar in their physical type, but then also that doe line, because it's just going to make the next step and the next progression of your herd that much easier for you.
Right. I definitely agree with that. I couldn't say that any better. And I think I was trying to say that, but you definitely brought that one home. You know, I've thought about bringing in, and I've discussed it with you and a few other people, about bringing in one more doe line that would be, you know, close enough related to maybe some of the sires that I'll be working with or am working with. And it's a tough decision. You know, I think right now, although it'd be fun and exciting, I think I'm dealing with some pretty nice and, you know, up and coming animals where maybe bringing in a new doe line doesn't make sense for a small herd like mine. You got to kind of build the foundation first before we start adding in, you know, a sun porch.
Right. Now, can I ask you a question about that though?
Yeah.
Okay. I am not an Oberhasli breeder.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I don't necessarily think Oberhasli have been on my radar consistently in what is out there except for the last couple of years. Just simply, I wasn't paying much attention to Ober Hosley of the United States until a couple of years ago. It wasn't on my radar. It was easier. You know, my eye went to different breeds. And the one thing I kind of take home from Ober Hosley is that there are probably, at least what you're exposed to at that national level and then the local level. And while they're both beautiful, beautiful animals, there are stark differences in the genetics, I want to say, but then also there are types there.
Oh, yeah.
And so with your herd, I personally feel like your type and what you are looking at is a different segment of the Ober Hosley breed than some of what you started with, as far as just your general look of what you are trying to achieve. And so while you're adding in what you want to achieve from the sire side with your foundation animals, are you looking to add a doe line because what you are naturally drawn to is not necessarily where your doe line is coming from?
You mean like from my doe line that I'm working with right now?
Right. So like,
yeah, no, I get what you're saying. So, yeah, it's probably a huge portion. I mean, if you look at where I started, which you saw, let's face it, I started with some very older school type Ober Hosley, you know, maybe a little bit more just like super dairy, but also kind of roachy and, you know, not the best mammaries. Heads were a little clunky. Like, that's just like the old school Ober Hosley, right? So I started with that and definitely trained my eye on what I want and my goals, and am working towards that. But yeah, when you like Mary Mac, you know, when I brought her in, and when I look at her now in a field with my breedings and then her not being my breeding, there's a pretty stark difference in style and, you know, overall type, right? I think me being drawn to maybe adding in another doe line is that, yeah, I want to get the type that I like faster, and, you know, achieve it quicker and then just be able to slap my farm name on that. Like, you definitely, like, you know, it's kind of like, it feels like you're cheating almost and cutting corners. So yeah, that's how I feel about it. You know? Yeah, for sure.
I wouldn't call it cheating and cutting corners.
Well, it's not cheating, but you know what I mean? Like, you're trying to get there faster.
Right. But I don't necessarily think you're trying to get there faster. I think it's basically the whole reason why, I mean, even if you look at it in a much bigger dairy goat picture of, not me particularly, but like, oh, somebody started in one breed because that was what was given to them, or that adorable Nubian with the little floppy ears was perfect for this kid, and that was the kid, and that's where we started. But then you expand and your dairy goat eye changes and what you like changes. And so then you see, oh, wait, you kind of go, oh, wait, I love my Nubians, but I'm actually let's go Alpine just because it's a different breed. I'm an Alpine breeder. I really like what I can do and what these Alpines are looking like. So ultimately, the breed for me right now is Alpine. So I think, and so you're not going to go, okay, well, I'm working with my Nubians and therefore I'm never going to be able to have an Alpine. No, you're going to decide, okay, where I want to go and what I want to see in my barn is this. How? And so let me get this and bring it in. Let me become an Alpine breeder because this is where I want to go. And I think it's the same thing. My style, and I'm not saying mine specifically, but as a breeder, your style is going to influence what you want in the barn, and you have to be able to get that. And sometimes that involves bringing in a new doe to start a new doe line to get you that style. And sometimes it means working with your doe line and bringing in other animals to influence and kind of tweak it. But it's ultimately making sure the animals in your barn are what makes you happy.
Yeah, I agree. It's to tie a neat little bow on it. Like, it's something that everybody has to consider when they're thinking about adding a new animal. I mean, like, yeah, like, I'm still considering, you know, the possibility. Hi, Tierney. Thanks for listening to my TED Talk. Hopefully you haven't made it this far. But yeah, like, I've considered, like, oh, okay, I could bring in a new doe from XYZ herd and then cut, you know, XYZ from my herd to be able to, you know, make it feasible and possible and people happy. And, you know, that's always an option down the road. But also, it's just like this neurotic thing in my head where it's like, well, I'd rather kind of also do the work myself and be like, well, look how many of Hilaire Farms animals are behind that pedigree, and look, you can see the building block between each animal, you know. So there's also that. I've had a conversation with someone where, like, yeah, I would totally bring in a certain doe from this doe line, and hopefully be able to raise them up and, you know, make a national champion, a reserve national champion out of that doe. But I also kind of want to have my first be on, you know, with my herd name in front of it, right? So it's just like something to think about for people. If you're thinking about adding something in, you can definitely, you know, do your homework and add it in and work off it. But I don't think, I've never understood people that would bring in a new doe line before just bringing in a new buck or AIing to a certain buck to create their next line, you know?
Yeah, I think it just goes back to, it's a lot kind of what we said earlier. When you are working with a doe line, to have success with it, it's a lot easier to know what you're working with and propel it forward than to be constantly kind of wiping that slate clean and starting all over again and relearning the quirks of what you're working with. Even from a non-show perspective, are you dealing with picky eaters? Are all of a sudden you going to be adding a doe line in who they'll turn their head and stop eating sweet feed when all of a sudden your dog is in the barn and they're just not a dog friendly line? So now all of a sudden you have to make sure while they're on the milk stand, your dog is not anywhere around, because otherwise your does won't eat. And then when they don't eat, they won't milk and they'll lose body condition and they won't be successful. Or are you bringing in something that's going to totally destroy your parasite resistance? And just, they're not a hardy line. And the second they have any worms, they're sick and they have diarrhea and this and that, and they don't necessarily work for you and your herd and your management. And so it's not even what you're learning intrinsically about what the animal looks like completely in relationship to the scorecard or linear appraisal or how it milks and the milk test results. It's also how it adapts to your management and how you adapt your management to them. And so when you add different animals in, you have to relearn that.
I agree. That's a perfect way to tie that up. So yeah, doe lines, that's just kind of one of those things where everybody has a different meaning for it. Kind of, all in all, it's, you know, a line that you've built through your breedings or started with. So yeah, that's doe lines. I think that's a great spot to wrap that up. I do want to just kind of reiterate to people that yes, we will be at convention. Danielle's going to be there all week with her tanks, so make sure you see what she's got up for grabs, and, you know, see if there's anything fun that you want to add into your herd. And then of course, Thursday, October 6th, In the morning, we'll be having a panel with Grace Toy. It's not ringside related, but we'll be talking about using social media to promote your dairy goat business and the goat industry. And 3 to 3:55 in Cotillion 3, Ringside Live, a conversation with Farmer John of Beekman 1802 Farm. We will be discussing with him all about Farmer John and figuring out who he is. And I'm really excited to see everybody. I'm excited for that panel. It's going to be a fun time. Kind of let down our hair and just relax and talk goats with people.
We will see you all in Syracuse. If you see us, be sure to stop us, say hi, introduce yourselves. We always appreciate talking to our listeners. So feel free to come say hi.
As always, if you like what you're hearing, go ahead on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review, good, bad, or indifferent. We would love to hear some feedback. It helps with the algorithm and helps us reach other like-minded goat people. We're also on the old social medias, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, wherever you socialize, we are there. And we also have a website, don't we, Danielle?
We do. You can always find us at dairygoatpodcast.com.
All right. Perfect. Well, guys, we'll see you at convention. Have a wonderful week. I'm John.
And I'm Danielle.
This has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast. We'll catch you on the next one. Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association. All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.